We'll call the Mining and Outdoor Recreation Committee to order. Representative Johnson, you've had a chance to review the minutes. Representative Johnson moves the minutes from January 21st. All in favor of approving the minutes from January 21st signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The minutes are adopted. Members, today we've got quite a lengthy agenda. We've had a little bit of trouble trying to deal with some of the things that are going on here today. We had 15 minutes taken away from us. We were supposed to be done at 4:15, and now we've got that 15 minutes back, so we are going to be here till 4:30. So a full agenda to try to get through, and we're going to have to move right along, and hopefully people can keep their testimony short so we can get through everything that we need to get through today. So with that, Okay, we're going to, today's hearing is on silica sand mining, and first up we're going to have Fred Corrigan and Peter Larson. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. We're delighted to be in front of this new mining committee and looking forward to getting to know you better over the next the rest of the session. I am Fred Corrigan. I'm Executive Director of the Aggregate and Ready Mix Association of Minnesota, a statewide association representing aggregate and ready mix producers. The Minnesota Industrial Sand Council is a council that's been created within our association to represent aggregate producers who are also involved in mining industrial sand. Our association has worked with the legislature since 1950 to clarify the regulation of the aggregates industry, including industrial sand. Most recently, the industry worked with the Legislative Aggregate Task Force for more than a year to produce a comprehensive report on the industry to the legislature in the year 2000 and to revise and increase the aggregate tax in 2008 at that time. The task force report and subsequent work by the non-metallic mining industry, the state legislature, and state agencies has successfully regulated this industry through local controls and state agency permits. Substantial efforts have been made by the legislature and local government to introduce aggregate resource protection into local comprehensive planning and land use controls and protect aggregate resources, including industrial sand, pursuant to Minnesota Statutes 8494. These efforts have also expanded the ability of the DNR Commissioner to issue and grant new leases to prospect for, mine, or remove silica sand from any lands owned by the state, including but not limited to school trust lands, tax forfeited lands, acquired lands, and beds of navigable waters at the same time as the DNR has been charged with increasing revenues from school land leases. Our members have non-metallic mining operations in the majority of Minnesota's 87 counties. These companies have been mining sand and gravel in some cases for more than 100 years. Industrial sand has been mined for glass production and foundry use for most of those years. It is our understanding there are only eight industrial sand mining and or processing operations in Minnesota at this time. Currently, proposed non-metallic mining operations above 20 acres need to complete an EAW, and those over 160 acres are required to complete an EIS. While the existing Minnesota review process has made Minnesota a safe place to mine and live, it can be a long process. The Minnesota Industrial Sand Council was formed so as to bring science-based solutions and recommendations to the agency and to the legislature. At this hearing, you have over 300 years of mining experience represented by companies who will testify and are currently mining industrial sand in Minnesota or in the permitting process to mine industrial sand. By conducting an EAW, you address all concerns regardless of the geographic location of a mine in the state, and at that time make a decision of whether an EIS is required. The membership of the Aggregate and Ready Mix Association strongly supports continued local control of the non-metallic mining industry. We also appreciate the working relationship our industry has with the DNR, MPCA, and EQB in updating best management practices and continue to participate in the multi-agency silica sand rulemaking advisory panel established by the 2013 legislature. Thank you for the opportunity to participate in today's hearing. We're excited to have this new House committee to work with and look forward to working with the chair and members of this committee on mining issues in Minnesota. With that, I would defer to Peter Larson, who has been counsel to the Industrial Sand Council over the last couple of years.
Thank you, Mr. Larson.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Peter Larson, Larkin Hoffman Law Firm here for the Industrial Sand Council. There's something in your materials that's green that I handed out, and I just wanted to catch folks up to what happened in 2013. If you weren't here in 2013 or weren't on the committee, you might not know all of the things that happened, which was really a description of what we've been doing since the 2013 legislature adjourned. There was a very busy session on this issue in 2013, and what I handed out for you is the conference committee report that turned into the law. So I just wanted to give you a sense of what was really widely regarded as a compromise between Representative Hansen at the time was the chair, was the author in the House, Senator Schmidt. Governor's office was very interested. There's lots of people in the room here that were there in 2013. So I thought it'd be a good thing just to go through and give you that basic understanding. The first item is called the Driftless Area Water Resources. You see 103G217. This is referred to as the Trout Stream Silica Sand Setback Permit. There was a lot of concern about trout streams in southeastern Minnesota. The agreement back in 2013 is there would be a new DNR permit that was required if you mined within a mile of a trout stream. And you can see in here, in order to get that permit, you have to do a hydrological evaluation, you have to identify setbacks, and you have to provide other information to the DNR that they think they need to protect that trout stream. They've actually got some guidance out on that now. I don't know that there hasn't been one applied for, but that was an important issue in 2013, and that exists today, notably only for silica sand mining operations. If you want to do something else within a mile of a trout stream, none of that applies. There is a silica sand mining model standards and criteria has gotten to be referred to as the EQB toolkit. You can just see it's page 121 going on to 122. You can just see how many issues were addressed in that toolkit. The EQB and the agency spent a lot of time doing that. You can move on. There's a technical assistance team on the page. It's page 123. Our testimony in 2013 was consistently if local governments want help from state agencies, if they feel overwhelmed, state agencies should be available. This was the law that got passed to make sure that would happen. Notably, on the bottom of that, then there's environmental review silica sand projects. You're going to hear from EQB about that, but there were some mandatory categories that were created. It was something that the industry and everybody agreed were appropriate, so there are mandatory categories for EAWs. Notably, the legislature considered and rejected an idea for a mandatory EIS. So you'll hear a little bit about that, I think, from the EQB and what they're doing. And then there's a EQB technical assistance library, which you can access online. And then finally, there's rules by the Pollution Control Agency, DNR, and Department of Health and EQB, and that's why folks are here. So I just wanted to point that out, that there was a whole basket of things that happened in 2013. We've essentially spent the last 20 months or so working with the agencies on that. We've got some issues that we really think we need to deal with the agencies in their rulemaking, and you're going to hear more about that. But I want to say, while we have some pretty significant improvements that we hope that they'll consider before they go out to rulemaking, we want to credit them for the access that they've given us. So I just wanted to give you that background. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Very good, Ms. Clark. Members, questions of these two testifiers? Seeing no questions, thank you very much for your testimony today. Next up, we have silica sand products and Merriam Junction sands. Okay. Jordan, I'm sorry. Jordan Sands and Merriam Junction Sands. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
Please state your name and who you represent for the record.
My name is Matt Bryan. I represent Bryan Rock Products Incorporated and Merriam Junction Sands. First of all, I'd like to thank the chairman for inviting us today, and we're very happy that the House decided to create a mining committee. There's a rich history of mining in this state, and I think it's important that it has a voice. As I said, my name is Matt Bryan. I'm the Vice President of Operations for Bryan Rock Products. I'm also a member. Our family is 50% owners in Merriam Junction Sands, and I'm also a board member of the Agri Ready Mix Association. Bryan Rock Products was started in 1941. I represent, and my brother Eric represents, the fourth generation of the Bryan family to run the business. We currently have pits and our quarries in Shakopee, Hastings, and Bayport. We have 28 full-time employees, and all of our mining is done by union staff. We have gone 26 years plus at all of our locations without a day lost accident. Our average years of employment at Brian Rock Products is 22 years. When people come to work for us, they stay. And in fact, we have had employees that are third generation of their family to work for Brian Rock Products. Brian Rock produces a variety of limestone products used in residential and municipal construction. We also produce agricultural lime. The product we're probably most known for that everyone might recognize us for is our Red Ball Diamond lime. Probably just about every baseball and softball field in the state of Minnesota has our Red Ball field lime on. You've probably washed it off kids or a softball uniform before. That's all produced in Shakopee, Minnesota. And Shakopee, Minnesota is where our project, Merriam Junction Sands, is based out of. Merriam Junction Sands was created several years ago as a business between with not just Brian Rock Products, but the Malkerson family. And we created it to permit and build and operate a silica sand quarry and processing facility. One of the most unique things about our project is we have the opportunity to continue operating just below the limestone that we've been mining in that area for 60 years. Silica sand is really no different than any other traditional aggregate in that the success you have really depends on the quality of the deposit. And in our case, after extensive exploratory drilling, we believe we have a world-class deposit with many years of reserves that also has the UP mainline, which is important for a successful silica sand processing facility. To date, we have gone 3 years in the permitting process and nearly costed $2.5 million. Once we get this facility up and running, once all permits, we believe that we can hire up to 25 to 30 full-time employees. Many of those will be union staff that work in the quarry itself. Just a little kind of a brief description of our permitting process. From the beginning, we knew because of the scope of our project, we would be doing an environmental impact study. It was discussed a little bit before. Environmental impact statement, I should say, which is the most detailed environmental review. An EIS covers any kind of impact or environmental issues you may have in your project. And we have to have that approved. We have to have that completed and approved by the county before we can get our IUP, which is an interim use permit, which we would get from the local unit of government. Our EIS will cover studies such as water, air, noise, wetlands, and traffic, and that's just a few. It's a pretty extensive study. Every section of that EIS is reviewed by both county and township and experts that they hire that are at the proposer's expense, along with state and federal agencies who have specialization in those areas. And we periodically will have meetings on those individual areas with the county and their staff of experts, along with the state agencies. Beyond the EIS and the IUP, we need to receive around 10 additional permits, such as a water appropriations permit from the DNR, along with an air emissions permit from the MPCA. And we look forward to working with those two agencies on our project. Once we get all permits, we then will have monitoring on our sites to verify that we are within compliance of all the requirements of our permit. And just kind of as an aside, you know, our business has been around since 1941, and beyond the state and local permits and regulations, miners work really hard to maintain positive relationships within all their communities. We don't run for as long as we have because we don't follow the rules or don't think about the people around us. And it really is maintaining safe and environmentally friendly working conditions are paramount for our success. So I just want to thank you for the time I have in front of the committee and pass over to Scott.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and who you represent for the record.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Scott Sustichek. I'm the Chief Executive Officer of Jordan Sands, located in Mankato, Minnesota. Our story really begins back in 2010 when our project was initiated and brought forward as a company. We proceeded to permitting in 2012, early in 2012, and just recently began operation in December of 2014. So as you can see, the time span of bringing a project like this forward is not insignificant. We are the only family-owned and operated, fully integrated mining, processing, and transload facility in the state of Minnesota. And we're pretty proud of that distinction of bringing forward really what's a relatively small project in the world of silica sand. Our operation is about 70 acres in total mining area. We're owned by the Coughlin family, which has a deep history of mining here in Minnesota. They've been mining dimensional limestone in Mankato for over 130 years. In fact, their limestone graces the Capitol building that you guys work in every day. And The move to mining sand and processing sand was a natural extension of those quarries' permitted lives. And so it became just a natural stepping stone for us to move forward in that fashion. Today, as we have begun operations last month, we employ 25 full-time people. Average hourly wage is in excess of $20 an hour, so very solid living wage for the greater Mankato area. And our employees come from the region, so from Mankato, North Mankato, St. Peter, Le Sueur, Good Thunder, Cortland, Madison Lake, Eagle Lake, Janesville, Pemberton, and Waseca. So we employ a large number of people from that demographic. Our impact to the greater Mankato area is significant. At the peak of the construction of our project, we probably had 75 to 85 construction workers on that site on a daily basis. We work with over 50 businesses in the local area just running our business day to day, from the union contractor that we've hired to do our stripping and mining to the corner gas station where we fuel our vehicles. The Greater Mankato Growth did a study early on as we were bringing this project forward and estimated that for every dollar of revenue that we earn out of the marketplace, there's a multiplier of 1.6 on it as it rolls through the community. So our economic impact will be right around $50 million to the Greater Mankato area. I just want to take the opportunity today to educate just briefly on the process of modern sand mining and what takes place. I would assume in most of your districts you've got aggregate or sand and gravel operations happening. The initial mining aspect of silica sand is really not a whole lot different than what you see in your aggregate operations today. From there, really, it moves into a highly automated state-of-the-art processing facility. The sand is washed as it comes out of the mine, and we use an extremely efficient closed-loop process where we're able to recycle 93% of the water that we use to wash and clean the sand. We've done this through, a state-of-the-art slurry system. That we've got over 3 miles of slurry piping that moves the sand back and forth. Then it moves into a drying facility. And again, we're utilizing state-of-the-art equipment from names like Carrier or Minnesota's own Donaldson, which has provided our dust collection system and helps keep our plant clean. From the time the sand enters the dry plant, it's completely contained. And so as it's being processed, as it's being screened by size, it's contained and dust is collected and pulled through that Donaldson dust collection system. It goes all the way to the rail car that way when it is ultimately then shipped to our customers. In short, we do appreciate this committee's attention to this and what could be a very dynamic industry for this state. We appreciate your interest in our business and the issues that we face as a growing company here in Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions, members? Okay, thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you
for coming today.
Sorry.
Okay, Shakopee Sands, Aaron Scott. Members, we started a little bit late. Took a little while to get a quorum today, so we are running about 10 minutes behind. So I appreciate everybody keeping their testimony short, and doesn't seem to be a lot of questions, but please speak up if you have questions. Welcome to the committee, and please state your name and who you represent for the record.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Aaron Scott, and I represent Shakopee Sands, Fairmount Santral. I'm the area manager for Fairmount Santral up here in the northern region, and we own and operate industrial sand mine and processing facility right here in Shakopee, Minnesota. I'm also a member of the Silica Sand Rulemaking Advisory Panel and have served on that panel over the course of this past year. As you know, the advisory panel was formed to provide input to the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, the State Department of Natural Resources, and the Minnesota Environmental Quality Board regarding new regulations applicable to silica sand operations in the state. The panel has citizen members, members from local government units, and members from the industrial sand mining industry. Fairmount is a well-established, highly experienced mining company that has been mining and processing sand for decades. In addition to our mining processing facilities in Shakopee, Fairmont operates a number of sand mines and related processing facilities in the northern region, including Wisconsin. We supply sand to a number of different industries as an industrial mineral. Some of those include the oil and gas industry, foundry, roofing market industry here in St. Paul in Minnesota, water filtration, construction, sporting turf, PGA Tour sand, and also play sand. Fairmont is proud of its strong record of environmental stewardship and its experience managing an important natural resource. For example, we were the first non-metallic mining company in the northern region to achieve green tier certification from the Wisconsin DNR. In a nutshell, that program requires participants to have a strong environmental record and commitment to exceed regulatory requirements. It also requires the adoption of environmental management systems. These are things Fairmont is committed to at the Shakopee, Minnesota facility as well. We're also committed to continuous improvement on issues related to environmental impact. In fact, it's a key part of our operating philosophy that we continuously look for ways to reduce our environmental footprint as well as ensure the protection of air and water resources and the health and safety of our workers and our neighbors in the communities. And in fact, in my region, our workers were over 1.5 million hours worked without a lost time accident in our region. And it's still going on today. Given our experience and strong commitment to sound environmental practices, we are pleased to have a seat at the table and be part of the advisory panel's work in examining proposed regulations. As an industrial mining company, we recognize the importance of appropriate regulation. Mining is among the most heavily regulated industries, and we do not object to that regulation, provided that it is clear, predictable, and its application, and most importantly, that it's based on sound science, not on fear or misinformation. And please understand that I don't use the term fear in an effort to criticize those that express concerns about this or any other industry. Fear is natural when it comes to issues of health and safety, but it should not be the form of basis for policy or regulatory decisions. There's been some interesting discussions throughout the course of the panel meetings, and it's been helpful to hear from many different perspectives from various panel members. However, with all due respect to everyone involved, many of the comments made by some are not based on sound science. Many of those comments appear to be based on misinformation or things that we don't understand about our industry. Any new environmental regulations applicable to industrial sand mining or other industry must be carefully tailored to address real impacts. The goal of rulemaking process should not be to limit sand as an industry or lawful use, but to address legitimate impacts. Importantly, this is not a new industry. There are substantial data and studies that address each of the issues that have been discussed by the advisory panel. For example, our Shakopee mine and processing facility have been conducting an ambient air monitoring program, which involves sampling for particulate matter and crystalline silica. I provided copies for the members on this committee. The summary of the air monitoring that we've done at Shakopee and additional information can be found at the MPCA's website. Our monitoring program began 2.5 years ago before our operations began, and it continues to the present day. It has been conducted in coordination with the MPCA, who has audited the program to ensure it meets all state and federal siting and sampling criteria for particulate matter monitoring. All MPCA audits have been found that the monitoring program is operating within those guidelines. And with respect to particulate matter, we did pre-mining sampling beginning in August of 2012 to determine the pre-existing amount of TSP and PM10 in the ambient air around the facility. We have since conducted ongoing monitoring while the facility has been in operation. And as a result, that was passed out, page 3 shows that we have had no impact on ambient particulate matter concentrations, and also both the before and after data shows that particulate matter concentrations are well below state and federal standards. The same has been true with respect to crystalline silica monitoring. During the time 46 samples were taken, 45 of the 46 were below detectable levels for crystalline silica, and the remaining sample that was detectable was substantially below the applicable exposure limit. Thus, our mining activities there in Shakopee have had no impact on ambient air quality with regards to crystalline silica.
Just one moment. We have a question. Representative Urusel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could we ask that testifiers, if they're going to refer to a document, since we have a number of things in our packet, if they could let us know which document they're referring to and, if possible, hold it up so we can pull it out successfully? Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah. Thank you. Please continue.
And the results at Shakopee are not unique. These same types of results have been obtained at other facilities, including a study we conducted at one of Fairmount's facilities in western Wisconsin, which I've also submitted as reference, an executive summary. The conclusion that we have reached is that based on science, based on the actual data from applicable studies, the current regulations are clearly adequate to address potential impacts to air quality. Frequently we hear from people that we have concerns about the industry, about the sand industry, and they're not really concerned about Fairmount or some of the other industries that have been around here for some time that are committed to consistently operating within applicable regulations. You know, the things that we hear at the panel meetings is that they're concerned about, you know, potential for other operators. But what really seems to be saying is that the regulations aren't sufficient, but that some operators may not comply with those regulations. So in other words, there isn't a need for more stringent regulation, but instead a need for more enforcement of the rules that are already in place. Any new regulations that are specifically to industrial sand should take into account that current regulations are working. And any changes must be based on careful consideration of the facts and the science. Otherwise, additional regulations only give concerned people a false sense that the state is doing something. Those regulations may do little, if anything, to protect the environment, but impose substantial additional burdens on the industry with no corresponding benefit. The basis for any proposed new regulations must be clearly articulated in order to demonstrate that they are, in fact, properly tailored to address an impact that is not adequately addressed under current standards. Thank you. I'd like to thank the
Thank you Mr. very Chairman much. Committee. Thank you for your testimony. Questions, members?
Tried to talk fast.
Representative Hertas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was wondering if Shakopee Sands could tell us if they are aware of or know what percentage of national production of silica sands are coming from their company. Last year we heard testimony on silica sand mining, and it was pretty clear that these deposits are unique in our nation to the glacial drift areas, and I'm just curious how reliant our country is on silica sand here in Minnesota.
Scott?
I don't have exact numbers, but as I stated before, our company provides to many different markets, you know, especially in this northern region. That same sand that we're selling into the oil and gas markets, we're also selling to roofing shingle companies here in Minnesota. There's foundries. We have many different markets that sand is used for. The idea with that material is our customer wants a clean grain of sand that's particular in size grain.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question wasn't with regard to specific use, but what percent of silica sand is mined in Minnesota nationally? And so do you have an idea of market share combined all of the uses? Because we know that there are glass manufacturers here in Minnesota that rely on the silica sand production, and we have a history in this region of having quite a few window manufacturers. They, I think, use glass. Roofing manufacturers as well. So I'm interested in knowing how reliant the nation is on a very important mineral.
I don't have percentage numbers. I apologize. I don't know. But as you stated, we are reliant because we use it in every day with the window providers and the glass providers that we also provide to here that provides to the Anderson Windows, the Pella Glass here in the state. I apologize. I don't know.
Sorry. Representative Urusa.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On the summary document, I'm just making sure I understand the tables. There's a heading that says TSP. What does that refer to? Under the particulate matter monitoring results.
Oh, yeah. Total
Scott.
Total suspended.
Representative Urusa.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What's the bottom, the minimum particle size that would have been captured for that? I mean, what sort of filtration was used and so on?
Mr. Scott?
You referred to the table on page 3 there?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's all of it. It's showing all of it.
Representative Urusa?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, what I mean is that you had to collect this material in some way, and typically that's done with some filter. And I'm because the measurements to the right of that are referring to the PM10. I'm just wondering how small particles were actually captured in this sort of sampling, and I don't know if you'd know that.
It's capturing everything, just like the other study that's shown. You know, it captures PM10 and also all the other particles that are smaller than that.
Representative,
this is done by a third party engineering firm that works with us and then also with the MPCA.
Representative Urso.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I suspect that what we know that you don't know what the answer to that is, and that's okay. I understand that, but there's.
We're going to get into some more testimony later on that's going to better describe some of those findings. So I kind of want to hold back a little bit.
Okay.
Representative Urso.
That's it.
Okay. Representative Mehta.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I actually, in reading the brief, my apologies for being late. I'll save my question till Section E.
Okay. Thank you. Any additional questions? Thank you very much for coming forward and testifying before our committee.
Thank you.
Thank you. Next is Uniman. Thank you for coming today. Please state your name and who you represent for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, committee, for your time today. My name is Gray Lusty. I'm a regional general manager for the Minnesota operations here for Uniman Corporation. Here today to, I guess, provide a bit of an introduction for the members that maybe don't know who we are and what we do, and also have with me Doug Losey, who will speak a little bit more to the specific environmental topics. Uniman is an industrial minerals company, actually the largest industrial minerals company in the U.S., in North America, and been around since 1970, so about 45 years that we've been around, and been operating in Minnesota since the early 70s. Purchased an existing silica sand operation just outside of Le Sueur, Minnesota, an operation that was actually shipping frac sand since the 40s. Uniman purchased it in the early 70s, constructed a new modern processing facility there, and has been operating there since. Shortly thereafter, in the early 80s, we constructed a second facility in Kasota, Minnesota, which is just north of Mankato, and we've been operating there since the early 80s. The Uniman Corporation here in Minnesota has been shipping not just the frac sand, but as part of a core part of our business, we also ship to local manufacturers within Minnesota, roofing manufacturers, glass manufacturers, foundries, and so forth. So we do have a diverse operation there that has been operating for some time. We do have about 200 unionized employees between the two operations. It's about two-thirds United Steel workers and about one-third are 49ers who work for D.H. Blattner, who is also a Minnesota company out of Avon, Minnesota. So we have a very big union workforce. We also have about 40 engineering and management folks. Our operations headquarters for all of North America is located in Mankato, Minnesota, which is where me and Doug are based out of. Uniman's had a very solid approach working with the agencies and with the local community throughout our history here in Minnesota. We've been through four environmental impact statements, two at Ottawa and two at our Kasota facility. Throughout those processes, we work very closely with both the local government and the state agencies, and also have partnered with a number of community organizations such as the Le Sueur County Historical Society, Save the Kasota Prairie, local emergency services, where we've made many large donations to the local ambulance services, fire and rescue services, the local hospital. We're partnered with the schools, the Prairie Ecology Bus Tour. So we've been very active in the community. We've been active environmentally, in addition to compliance with all of our permits and our environmental studies. So with that, I would turn it over to Doug Losey.
Mr. Losey, please state your name and who you represent for the record.
Good afternoon, Chairman.
Good afternoon.
Committee members. My name is Doug Losey, and I work with Unum Incorporation. I'm their General Manager of Environmental Affairs for U.S. and Canada, based here in Minnesota. Most familiar with the Minnesota facilities as I've been working with them the longest. Unumin is very accustomed to following the environmental regulations here in Minnesota and has been doing so for a long time. As Gray mentioned, we've completed four complete EIS processes. Those have typically taken us, on average, 4 years to complete. They cost us about $5 million on average, and that's before we enter into the permitting process. That process was something that certainly has been in place and we're in favor of. And we have worked with LeSueur County, our local governmental unit, cooperatively. That's brought transparency with our community and has worked very well. During this past rulemaking period, I've been the person from Unumin that has been representing our company on the Silica Sand Rules Advisory Panel. We're appreciative to have a seat at the table to work through these rulemaking processes. And that continues here for one more meeting next month. So we've been working through that. We do have some concerns with the air permit rulemaking process. We have concerns that the restrictive nature of the current proposed rules will inhibit innovation and potentially restrict flexibility to implement other effective improvement, proven best management practices. Unumin has a long history of not only complying with environmental rules, but conducting innovative research and development. In our past, we invented the system called the low-velocity dust collection system. And we've shared that with the industry across the board because it's very, very effective and something that we employ at our Minnesota facilities and others in the company. We continually look at new ways to make our industry and reduce our footprint on the environment and our community. So we're looking at, as Gray had mentioned, we've been in this business for 45 years, and we have plans to be in the business for 45 plus years into the future. Unumin has invited Dr. Richards here to testify with regard to some of his research that he's been doing with regard to monitoring air impacts in our industry. He has been working with Unumin regarding our air monitoring program over the last few years. He will be providing some useful information, and I'm glad we were able to have him here today to speak with you. I want to thank you for allowing us to talk with you here.
Thank you. Very good. Thank you. Representative Cornish.
Sir, a number of people that have come up have mentioned Mankato. Which ones actually operate in or near Mankato of the organizations here, like in Lyme Township and Mankato? Would that be the previous ones? And then where is yours at then?
Representative, we are located in LeSueur County, both of our operations. Our Kasota operation is just north of the Blue Earth County line, so we're very close to Blue Earth County, which is where Mankato is, but we're actually in LeSueur County. Our Kasota facility, our Ottawa facility, is also in LeSueur County, but on the north end, closer to LeSueur.
Okay. I've got all of Blue Earth County except Mankato and Lyme Township, and then a little bit of LeSueur County, so I'm close to you. A lot of my people work and live around your company there, and I assure you that the greater Mankato area is a majority approve of your business, and thank you for your the economic impact you have in our area, so thank you.
Thank you, Representative.
Members, other questions? Representative Hurtas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Reviewing some of the information, the data from the different silica sand producers, and we've heard that different types of sand are used for different reasons, from window manufacture or glass manufacturing, to be more specific, also roofing components. I want to ask or clarify that in the case of frac sand, silica sand for glass, the different grades of sand, the processing of it, all of these sands are coming from the same deposits, the same strata. It's currently what you're already mining. Is that correct,
Mr. Lusty?
So for our Minnesota operations here, yes, 100% of our sand comes from the what's called the Jordan Sandstone, which immediately underlies the dolomite, which is the dimension stone limestone layer that others have spoke about previously. So for us here now, for our operations in other states, in Illinois and Wisconsin, you know, there are other geologic strata. But one of the things that makes this particular sand very valuable, and I think somebody alluded to it earlier, is that the deposits are the grains are fairly coarse, which makes it a very valued commodity, because that coarser sand produces a grade of fracturing sand that is in shorter supply, shall we say, as opposed to some of the deposits in Wisconsin and Illinois that tend finer, right, as the particle sizes.
Representative Hertas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So to be clear then, the Unanim in your case acquired a mining operation that was established long before 1970. You've been mining in this silica sand for the last 40 years, 45 years, and the disturbance to this deposit has been something that we've been doing in Minnesota for quite a long time, nearly 100 years, I think I recall last year testimony. So what we've seen is that we've been in the same strata, we've been mining the same strata, and what we've continued to do is improve upon the handling of the material and the treatment of it environmentally.
Mr. Lusty, comment?
Yes, no, I think that's accurate. I think we've improved techniques in reclamation. We've certainly improved techniques in health and safety, in our environmental stewardship programs, our community outreach. I mean, certainly we've developed quite a bit, but the core of our business is essentially the same. The original plant that was built in the 40s in Ottawa, Minnesota, was for fracturing sand as well as glass and foundry. And those businesses haven't changed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for that clarification.
Thank you.
And testifying.
Thank you, gentlemen. Thank you for coming forward. Oh, Representative Metza, we're running about 20 minutes behind, so if
I'll
it's
be
very quick.
Real quick, and okay. Say yes or no, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just wondering, in regard to the particulate study, has there been any case since 1970 when you started your business of an employee becoming sick from silica?
Mr. Lusty.
I'm not sure I'm the guy to answer that. Historically we've been monitoring the health of our employees for some time, and I think for us, we've documented that we haven't created a case of silicosis within our business in that history, but we bought a lot of companies that we didn't, previously operate.
Representative Metza?
That's all I have, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much for coming forward and testifying today. Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
Really appreciate it. Next up, Aggregate and Ready-Mix Association.
Thank you again, Mr. Chair. I'm Fred Corrigan. I'm Executive Director of the Aggregate and Ready-Mix Association. I just want to change direction here a little bit and talk about what the rest of our members do, and that is to mine in construction aggregates, and those are the aggregates that are in pretty much all 87 counties of the state, whereas silica sand is basically in the southeast corner of the state, from the Minnesota River over to the Mississippi River and up to the Twin Cities area. It has been our concern through this entire process that rules being developed for silica sand not transfer to negatively impact the mining of construction aggregates in those other essentially 70 counties around the state. And we continue to be concerned about comments that we're hearing from counties that say they are not in a position to manage two different ordinances, one for sand, one for aggregates, and if they're put in that position, they will take the regulations that come from the state and apply them to all mining, and that's what they will enforce. And that's been our worry all the way through. Again, we have participated in the task force that will complete its work next week or next month, and hope we will have made some progress to make sure that that doesn't happen. As you've heard, that task force is looking at air quality issues, reclamation, and also some of the EQB standards. And I'm just going to spend a minute here with you with the EQB issues, one of which is a proposal to reduce the number of acres for a mandatory EIS from 160 acres to 80 acres. And we think that's unnecessary and uncalled for. More than 90%, and our members say probably 99%, but I don't have that number that precisely, of the new permits that are generated in Minnesota for construction aggregates do not require an EIS. They go through the EAW process, they clear up the issues that are identified in the EAW process, and are approved by local governments and state agencies at that level without going to a full EIS. Those that do go to an EIS are typically more complicated, and we're going to talk to Mr. Beckin, is going to talk a little bit about one of the more complicated EISs. But as Unanim mentioned, typically an EIS is $1 million a year and typically takes between 1 and 4 years to accomplish, or in their case, 5 years. So yeah, it's an expensive process, and that's a process that a construction aggregates operation cannot afford. Simply cannot afford. 50% of the aggregates in this state that go to construction aggregates go to road and bridge accounts. You're buying that product, and I don't think many of these operations can afford at that level of permitting. And our experience has been that they're not needed. With that, Mr. Chair, I'd like to introduce Tim Beckin, who's worked in a number of these projects, including the UMOR project in Dakota County.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and who you represent for the record.
Good afternoon. My name is Tim Beckin. I'm with Semstone Products Company in Mendota Heights and Dakota Aggregates, both in Mendota Heights. I'm fourth generation company based in St. Paul. We've been in business for about 87 years providing sand and gravel and ready-mix concrete throughout the state. And we have been active in both mining sand and gravel for well over 80 years. And that goes from everything from large operations, which we'll talk about, to very small operations in towns like Aiken, Minnesota, and Isle, Minnesota, and Bram, Minnesota, and all many places around the state. In almost all of those cases, we were able to, most of those sites are in the 80-acre range, and it mostly is EAWs are all that's required and really truly needed in those many situations that we're able to handle what's needed and to be able to get a permit and to provide aggregates really in a very small area. I mean, generally speaking, aggregates are only trucked 20, 30 miles. That's really about the distance that it can be economically trucked. I have personally been involved in two EISs, both of them in one in Empire Township, Minnesota, and one in Rosemount, Minnesota. And the one in Rosemount that we just recently completed, it was our operation Dakota Aggregates. We are mining the University of Minnesota UMOR Parkland, and after a long process, we were successful in getting that contract. And we went through a full EIS there because ultimately it's 1,800 acres, of which 900 is in Rosemount and 900 in Empire Township. It'll be the largest sand and gravel operation really in the Twin Cities because it's the last big outwash of the glaciers. Well, we went through that process. It took us about 5 years. It took us several million dollars, and we really were able to be exhaustive in terms of the needs and what needed to be done on a project of that scale. But that is really truly the one end of the spectrum. Our big fear is actually with small projects in places like Frontenac, Minnesota, and Aiken, where we've seen already where counties have said, we don't want to have two permits, we want to go just down to one. And so we've just seen a real transition from silica sand kind of regulations and rules coming into small operations where we make sand and gravel depend on based on road projects if they're available from year to year. And so that's really our challenge. I think our industry, we really try hard to do a good job, and we've really worked and perfected what needs to be done. And so that's just kind of our concerns. With that, that's my testimony, so thank you.
Very good. Thank you. Members, we're running really short on time. We've got a huge agenda ahead of us, so let's try to keep questions brief if we can. Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a comment, a real quick one. Mr. Beckin, thank you to you and your family for working with our Minnesota DNR and the UMAR project. I think the innovative work that your company is going to do there, where we're going to mine that gravel, and then my grandkids will get to enjoy that as a wildlife management area, and yet we'll keep the cost of building a home down in the southern metro. I really appreciate that. I look forward to working with you on the challenge of the lock and dam being closed at St. Anthony and finding a way to get the aggregate to your concrete plant in downtown Minneapolis and from Great Crowd Island. So thank you, and the good work you do, and for the good jobs you provide, specifically in my own community where you do operate the concrete plant there. So thank you.
Thank you. Members, other questions? President Wood.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Since I heard the word Aiken several times, I just wanted to comment. Aiken County Highway Department operates a pretty significant gravel mine themselves, plus a lot of local contractors operate on their own gravel mining operations to support our townships and county and highway departments. So I certainly share the concern that we don't over-regulate this this business, because there certainly isn't enough money to go around in transportation today. So, but as a taxpayer in Aiken County, our county actually operates a mining operation, and it's a very important one. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you,
Mr. Bachman. Thank you, Mr. Corrigan. Next, we're going to have Dr. John Richards. Members, after Mr. Richards, we're going to have some testimony from some of the different state departments, and hopefully they will be able to keep things brief, and we'll be able to take some public testimony. We've got about another 45 minutes of committee, about another half an hour, and would like to leave the last 15 minutes for public testimony. Thank you for coming, Dr. Richards. Please state your name and who you represent for the record.
My name is John Richards. I work with Air Control Techniques, and Mr. Chairman, I appreciate the opportunity to come here today and talk about PM4 crystalline silica data I've compiled since the 2012 time period. And I think that'll help inform some of the debates about the potential exposure in the communities nearby. And I've worked with a number of companies in Wisconsin, and I have some data to share. It's in the form of this handout, which looks like a fairly long PowerPoint, and I promise I'll get through it expeditiously here, and I've tried to condense a few slides to save a little time, but it'll be here. If I skip over some material, I apologize, but again, it's back in the packet, so I'll try to take advantage of that to save a little time.
Thank you, and we're honored to have you today.
Okay, thank you. Real quick on my background, I'm not going to go over all this, but I have 45 years of experience in the air quality field. I've been working specifically on ambient crystalline silica for about 20 years, so it's not a new subject to me. Certainly things have been changing over time. I'll be using a term fairly frequently, so let me give a very brief introduction. I'll be talking about PM4. That means particulate matter in the size range from 0 up to 4 micrometers. And just to define that term, a human hair, the average human hair, is about 50 to 70 micrometers. So if you took a scissors and cut a cross-section, you could put about 20.
Doctor, could you speak a little more? Just the mic so you could.
Sure.
There. Thank you.
But these small particles, the 2.5 particles, would go 20 across a human hair. A PM4 size particle, there'd be somewhat fewer going across a human hair. But again, we're looking at very small particulate matter. And in the regulatory definitions, by the way, there's some slight differences, which I don't think I have time to really address. Crystalline silica is ubiquitous material. It's about 12% of the Earth's crust. It comes from a large number of sources, so there is a background that I'll have to take into account when I'm measuring ambient concentrations. And that background comes from sources such as windblown dust, farming, global transport of dust, and you do get dust from Africa and Asia in this part of the country, public unpaved roads, industrial sources, construction, and a number of others that I just haven't listed. But again, there are a number of sources all contributing fairly low levels of crystalline silica. This is not a new issue with respect to ambient exposure. It's certainly a long-term issue that has been addressed by industrial facilities much more than 30 years. In terms of ambient concerns, it has been looked at a number of times over the last 15 years, and in each time, the agencies, primarily the US EPA, has come to the conclusion that the existing national ambient air quality standards for things such as PM10 provide sufficient protection to the public from crystalline silica and a number of other things for which they don't have specific ambient standards. Some concerns were first raised in Wisconsin, I think, in the 2011 to 2012 time frame. I was approached by several companies in a fairly short time frame back then to try to compile some data to address that concern, because I don't think anybody wanted to wait years and years before there was some accurate data to rely on. So studies were started in 2012. As you can see from the map, they're primarily in the western Wisconsin area, and they involved, in this particular case, I'll be talking about four companies. One was Fairmont Santrell, Matthey Construction, U.S. Silica, and EOG Resources. Between those, I had eight facilities, actually 19 separate sampling locations, a fairly large number of samplers. And just to put that into perspective, I'll be talking primarily about a set of 19 samplers. And the state of Minnesota runs 22 PM2.5 samplers. So if you get a general comparison of the scale of the networks, it's a fairly large network that's running, and a lot of data has been compiled. And I'll be talking about some of that data as I go through here fairly quickly. There is not an established reference method for ambient crystalline silica because, again, this is not something EPA has considered a priority. Certainly no one wanted to wait for a method to come out. So what I did back when the issue first was raised in California a number of years ago was to develop a method based very closely on EPA's 2.5 sampling procedure, which is the most sophisticated particulate sampling procedure we have. So this was the best on the books for sampling. We adjusted it very slightly so it could do PM4 particulate matter, and then we brought in one other addition. The samples were analyzed using NIOSH's reference method for crystalline silica, the same method that's been used for occupational exposure analyses over many, many years. So it's a well-recognized, accepted method. So we had two very strong reference methods as a foundation. The equipment was readily available, and so that, for those reasons, it made sense to start the analysis using those materials. The samplers were set up in an upwind downwind situation. Again, we had a background issue, so there had to be an upwind station where we could assess the levels from sources offsite, and then there was a downwind location so we could look at the contribution of the facility to those. So we had a difference that we could analyze. Here's a quick summary of the measurement results. And again, this morning, as I shrunk this talk to try to fit into the best possible time frame, we've got a typo which we need to correct. As you'll see, this slide differs a little bit from the one in your package. At the Maiden Rock facility, there are three sampling locations. We've got 370 samples. And the average PM4 crystalline silica concentration ran 5 to 15% of the Minnesota health-based value of 3 micrograms per cubic meter. At Downing, which is a little bit north of Maiden Rock, we had two locations in an upwind-downwind arrangement. 125 samples, the long-term concentrations were less than 5% of the Minnesota value. Cataract Green was actually a greenfield site. It was a farm that was no longer active. It was nothing but a grass-covered field with no truck traffic or other sources nearby. And there were, again, 5% of the Minnesota health-based value. EOG had 12 locations. Actually, those were in four separate facilities, three mines, one processing plant. Had over 1,000 samples. Each sample, by the way, was a 24-hour number. The long-term average was, again, less than 10% of the Minnesota health-based value at all those particular sites. And at the last one was Sparta, one location, 90 samples. In this case, we're in a community just north of the plant, and the long-term average was less than 5% of the Minnesota health-based value. So Here we have a data set of more than 1,700 24-hour values, and we're consistently, the long-term average was consistently a small fraction of the value. And for that matter, we're in the background concentration range, and one good example of that is Cataract Green was basically a background station. One other comparison, I've taken that 1,700 set of data, and that's the top part of this slide, and compared it with the Minnesota PCA data from Winona. They start a little bit later. They've only got 30 samples, but if we look at the values, the data sets look very similar in terms of the magnitudes of the numbers and the number of samples that are above the detectable limit. When we look at individual sites, and I won't spend much time on this, but when you look at day-by-day comparisons, the upwind and downwind numbers to try to see the contribution of the facility that day, we generally find there's no difference whatsoever in the PM4 crystalline silica concentration going from upwind to downwind as the air mass passes over the facility. A few cases will be higher, a few cases will be lower, and that's probably because our background levels are a pretty important and dominant factor, really, in the concentrations. I won't spend much time on this either, but Wisconsin has looked in other areas, in urban areas, using other types of samplers and analyses and gotten concentrations very similar to what we got. So again, there's some additional confirmation that we're seeing something very typical throughout the state. Then one other one, which I like to show, is an entirely independent study. The method we developed was also simultaneously developed by the South Coast, which is Los Angeles, Air Quality Management District. They went out to a city of Duarte to an elementary school, and I won't spend a lot of time, but they looked at Royal Oaks Elementary School, which was surrounded by four large sand and gravel operations within about a mile to 2.5 miles. Regardless of wind direction, they were downwind of one of them, so it was an interesting place to do a study. And their concentrations that they measured were a little bit higher than Wisconsin, probably because of the arid character of that part of California, but still a small fraction of the Minnesota health-based value and the California health-based value. So again, we have confirmation from variety studies, some entirely independent, that the concentrations are very low and within the background level that we see. So that's the main, I guess, conclusion I have to offer from this data set, that the data we've measured by the best possible methods with extensive QA and with Wisconsin DNR looking over our shoulder, both on the protocol written before the study and also auditing the samplers during the study, I think we have a good set of data and some accurate information to pass on about the prevailing levels around that. And these levels are not a surprise. Given the characteristics of crystalline silica, it's hard to grind it down to that size. The material is wet. The controls are advanced because, again, there's been occupational concerns that have been addressed. So there's not a surprise that we saw these data, but this level of data, this quantity of data, had not previously been developed, and I hope it's some help to everybody as they consider how to address silica sand mining. And then one other comment, or actually two other comments. We've got data similar to Winona, and as you get more data, you'll have a better opportunity to compare the data from the PCA sampling programs to the data we've got. So I'd encourage you to take that opportunity. And also, this data will be available in some peer-reviewed journals here. It's a slow process, but hopefully these will be out sometime this year. So, and as time goes on and more studies are done, I think there'll be more of this data get out in the literature, so there's a database people can refer to make scientifically-based judgments about exposure. Thank you. Any questions?
Thank you very much, Dr. Richards. Well, I have a question to start with, just kind of a basic question, Dr. Richards. In Wisconsin, you mentioned the DNR a couple of different times. Are they the primary regulatory agency for the state of Wisconsin? Are there other agencies that oversee this issue, or is it primarily the DNR?
I can answer from my perspective. My contact has been entirely with DNR and their sampling folks. We met with them before we started the studies, took some recommendations on how they would do it. For example, they asked us to blind all the samples so the lab would never know what plant or what location was provided the filter, and other areas like that. But that's been the main group, in fact, the only group that I've had any contact with over this two-year period.
Thank you, Dr. Richards. And members, let's see, we've got about another half an hour left. And Dr. Richards, thank you for keeping things brief and shortening up your testimony. I really appreciate it. But still a very, very good job. Members, questions. Representative Urizo. Dr. Richards, we've got some questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The sampling method relies on filtration, right? So what's the minimum particle size that gets collected in this method?
Here we use PVC filters, and we've had to use PVC filters so that we can conduct the NIOSH method 7500. And we'll have 99.9% efficiency down to 0.3 micrometer size particles with that. And that's the standard spec that comes out of NIOSH methods.
Representative Ubersol.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this sampling was done in the plant location where, as you said, it's wet processing. Has there been any similar sampling done around transfer facilities where people are loading the dry material onto different transportation?
No, we have not done a test around the transload facilities. These have all been fence lines around sand mines or processing plants.
Thank you.
Okay. Additional questions? I don't see any, Dr. Richards. Thank you very much again for coming. Yep. Very, very interesting. Okay, next up we're going to hear from some of the agencies. If you want to come forward, the Minnesota EQB. Come forward and please state your name and who you represent for the record.
Mr. Chairman, Will Seifert, Environmental Quality Board.
And Mr. Seifert, I think we're going to have to shorten things up a bit, so if you could be as brief as possible. We're trying to get the agencies done in probably about the next 15 minutes. Thank you for coming, though.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, committee members. I will try to be brief. thanks again for the invitation to present to you this afternoon. We're asked to present to you today about EQB rulemaking for silica sand. You got a quick preview of this from Mr. Larson, but the various initiatives here on this slide were authorized by House File 976, Chapter 114. Some created additional regulations at the state level, some authorized rulemaking, which we'll get into today, and others directed the state to provide assistance for local regulation and decision-making. This is a picture of all the state agency activities related to silica sand since 2013. The EQB has done extensive public outreach on these initiatives to get broad-based feedback and address concerns as they arise. The board provided a venue for local government, industry, and citizens to shape the development and implementation of the 2013 silica sand legislation. The board and EQB staff have held numerous community meetings throughout southern Minnesota and the Minnesota River Valley, conducted surveys, opened comment periods, and established a panel to advise on rule development. This has aided in gathering feedback efficiently, bringing policymakers together in one place on a regular basis, and ensuring public accountability. The EQB plans to continue this outreach as we move forward implementing the remaining directives from 2013. As you can see from this slide, our rulemaking effort is but one element of a patchwork of initiatives that were supported or authorized in 2013 to support and augment local efforts. The 2013 legislation directed three separate agency rulemakings. The EQB rulemaking was specific to considering new environmental review thresholds for silica sand projects. In an effort to facilitate an efficient exchange of ideas and ease of access to agency resources, a rulemaking advisory panel was created as authorized by the Minnesota Administrative Procedures Act. Specifically, Minnesota Statutes 14.101 authorizes the use of an advisory committee to aid in the development of rules. This panel began meeting regularly in Oronoco, Minnesota, in January of 2014 and is expected to wrap up its work next month. The panel consists of five representatives from industry, five citizens, and five local government representatives. We want to reiterate our appreciation for the people who volunteered their time each month to roll up their sleeves on some pretty technical issues. Many of them traveled long distances and have other jobs not related to silica sand. This was a big sacrifice for them. Their contributions have really aided the agencies in refining their preliminary concepts and will undoubtedly shape the rules that are proposed later this year. Panel meetings were facilitated by MMB facilitators, and ideas were shared spanning various issues. There were and still are healthy disagreements among many of the participants, but good information was exchanged, constructive advice was offered, and overall it was a good educational process for all involved. This is a unique effort in that the same panel was created and used for three separate agency rulemakings. While this was intended to create efficiency and bring all stakeholder perspectives to one central place, it created challenges balancing the need to cover extensive amounts of content in a relatively short time frame. While it would have been ideal if consensus was reached, the panel was not created to find consensus, given the divergent interests and lack of time. But it was created to foster a constructive stakeholder dialogue, find common ground where it existed, and advise the agencies on rule development. SIDE presents a very simplified overview of the rule process. We are currently here. One thing to emphasize here is that although this is only one box on the chart, it is the longest and arguably most important part of rulemaking. This is where the agency develops the rule and works with stakeholders to get input on the front end. One of the reasons that the rule process is so complex is that it is designed to ensure that the public has multiple chances to weigh in on the rule, both at the very initiation of a rulemaking and later in the process, through comment periods and a hearing in front of an administrative law judge. It is worth noting that once any of the agencies propose a preliminary rule, there will be a formal comment period, and agencies are required to respond to comments. There are multiple points throughout the process that a rule proposal is subject to changes. The language on the screen is our directive as passed by the 2013 legislature. We are working with the panel on putting together a proposal for the board to consider later this spring. We are also sending out a survey to local governments to get their perspective on potential changes. The current non-metallic mining environmental review thresholds established in 1982 in Minnesota Rules 4410 were developed pursuant to the public participation process and on the basis of the history of environmental review for these activities. As a reminder, I shared these thresholds with you in our presentation last week. I want to make a note real quickly that the new categories that we're discussing and proposing are not new non-metallic mining categories. They're new categories for silica sand projects. And if you go back to the language that was shared with you earlier, it's clear in the language that silica sand does not include common rock, stone, aggregate, gravel, sand with the low quartz level, or silica compounds recovered as a byproduct of metallic mining. So changes that we're talking about in the thresholds will not impact non-silica sand producers. And briefly here, this is the interim rule that is in effect until July 1 of 2015. And this states that for projects that excavate 20 or more acres of sand, an EAW is required and the local government unit is the RGU. And then projects that store 7,500 tons or have a throughput of 200,000 tons, the MPCA is the RGU for environmental review. And these, again, were set by the 2013 legislature. Shortly after the legislature adjourned, we published a request for comments. These are not all the comments that we received, but these are some of the themes that continue to reemerge in panel discussions. So in the interest of time, I'm going to jump to the next couple slides. We've been doing outreach to all stakeholders, as you can see here. We've been touring facilities, meeting with local government representatives. We are working on a survey one last time for local governments. We've had a panel going, and then we work closely with agency technical experts. And this is the latest iteration of rule concepts that has been shared with the panel for discussion purposes. There is broad support, or I would characterize it as broad acceptance, for making the interim thresholds permanent. That was the previous slide. Building off of these thresholds, there are some additional concepts that we are exploring based on comments received in the request for comments and input from the panel. Some themes that emerge are that projects that are in close proximity to sensitive features, such as designated trout streams, sensitive shoreland, should have lower EAW thresholds. Impacts can be regional and or may benefit from state technical expertise. So we're exploring designating state agencies as RGUs in some circumstances. For instance, standalone processing and transloading facilities and mines proposed in the designated trout stream back area. Some projects are so large that there may be the potential for significant environmental effects. So we are considering reducing the EIS threshold for silica sand mines to as low as 80 acres and requiring it for underground mines. Upon completion of the panel process next month and a review of the survey sent to local governments, we'll consult with the EQB Silica Sand Subcommittee and bring a rule proposal to the full board for approval later this spring. This is an iterative process, and these concepts will continue to be refined as we hear more from potentially impacted stakeholders and as we learn more about projects under consideration. So, Mr. Chairman, thank you for the opportunity to be here today, and thank you for giving us the opportunity to hear from all the companies that presented earlier.
Thank you, Director. Thank you for coming back again today. I know you were just here last week, too. Representative Metza.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just had a couple questions. Are we still short on time?
We're very short on time.
So we can talk offline, but I did want to get on public record. Is there a precedence for the vote that took place this last year and the board overriding an agency?
Director?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I don't understand what you're asking.
Could you be
asking
more specific?
I guess I'll hold it for offline. This could get to be quite time-consuming.
Very good. Did you have a comment, Director?
That's fine. Yeah, no.
All right, thank you. Thank you for coming in again today.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, next on the agenda, Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. Again, like I stated earlier, if we could be as brief as possible, thank you for coming in.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Catherine Neuschler. I'm the supervisor of the Agency Rules Unit at the Pollution Control Agency. So I'm just going to kind of follow Mr. Seufert's lead and kind of go through our legislative charge here. 2013, the legislature directed us to make rules concerning particulate emissions because these pollutants do have adverse health impacts, as you've heard. Our first step was to initiate our rulemaking with a preliminary notice and request for comments. Some of the highlights of the comments that we received related to air pollution and particulate emissions in that process were statements that ambient air standards, which are those standards that limit the amount of pollution in the general air that the public has access to, must be stringent and protective of human health, that all facilities should be required to have an air emission permit, and that all facilities should be required to conduct monitoring of ambient air pollutant levels. And in addition, we've received a lot of response that all requirements should be meaningfully enforced. We then began the advisory panel process in January of 2014. We began from the PCA side by presenting information to the panel about air regulations, air permitting, and air monitoring. And we asked the panelists to share with us their interests and concerns about the control of air pollution from silica sand facilities. Their responses to us focused on protecting human health and making rules based on sound science. Taking into account that input and looking at relevant regulations, which include federal regulations for similar types of activities, regulations on silica sand or similar industries in other states, the staff developed what we called an air rule concept document, and we shared that with the panel to try to just lay out our basic rule structure. The key pieces of that document included monitoring of particulate pollution near silica sand projects or facilities, and requirements for pollution control practices and equipment to minimize particulate pollution from the specific processes that take place at the silica sand mining and processing facilities. After going through that structure and taking input from the panel, what we did was we fleshed out our concepts and provided a more narrative or plain language description of what the rule may require and how it could work. And one of the goals of that document was to help us get meaningful public input, not just from the panel, but from all of our stakeholders. And our hope was that that would be something that would be easier for the public to engage with if it wasn't written all in legal regulatory language that can sometimes look like a finished product. We shared the plain language narrative with the advisory panel, and then we published a second request for comments in the State Register to ensure we were getting feedback from all our interested parties. The response to our second RFC was mixed. Comments generally focused on the proposal to require air monitoring at all facilities, which I'm sure doesn't surprise you as you've heard a lot about that this afternoon. Comments also focused on the specifics of the proposed pollution control practices and equipment, compliance and enforcement of both emission controls and ambient air standards, and the need for individual air emission permits. In terms of air monitoring, I would characterize the responses we received as showing that cities and citizens largely are supportive of requiring monitoring, while industry expressed concerns that the monitoring being envisioned is excessive and unlike anything done for other sources with similar emission levels in Minnesota. Again, I think you've heard that today. Similarly, there was a mixed response on the appropriate stringency of the pollution control practices and pollution control equipment that the draft concepts put forth. And several commenters, again, wanted to ensure that the rules are strictly enforced. Finally, some commenters stated that individual air permits should be required of all facilities over a certain size. And I just want to take a quick digression to something we weren't able to share last week. One of the ideas we are considering for the rule is the requirement for an individual air emission permit for all silica sand facilities over a certain threshold. The big difference here between the individual permit is that the individual permit requires separate notice and comment and is specific to the facility that's being permitted. We have general permits for many of our sand and gravel facilities, but those are only public notice when they're developed. They apply to a lot of facilities, and they're not site-specific. So after hearing that input from the panel, reviewing the comments we received, we developed draft rule language. We've walked through it with the panel in December and January. I do have to emphasize, as Mr. Swiper said, this is just a draft. We're just at the concept stage, and our goal was to put all the options on the table and to get feedback from all the members of the panel. And again, we've heard a lot of that feedback today. The draft rule suggests individual air permits for all sources over a certain threshold. We're currently looking at what that threshold should be. We're considering 200 tons of sand per day, but that's still under discussion. And this applicability threshold is where we're really going to be using the rules to sort of differentiate between who's in and who's out. The draft rule also suggests monitoring of ambient pollution levels at the fence line of a facility designed to ensure that the air that the public is exposed to meets ambient air quality standards and the health-based value for silica set by the Department of Health. The rule, thirdly, has various pollution control practices and equipment for controlling particulate emissions from processes within the facility. In general, pollution control equipment is some kind of add-on technology that can be used to control pollutant emissions, while pollution control practices are used where that add-on technology is not available. So what the rule includes is emission limits based on the performance of the control technology for processes like drying and crushing that are funneled to one opening invented through a more traditional smokestack. And then it includes things like a fugitive dust mitigation plan to control dust from roads and stockpiles and the kinds of emissions that don't go through a smokestack but just come up into the air. Compliance is envisioned as being upon startup for new facilities, and that there would be a defined time for existing facilities to come into compliance with the new regulations. So that's the summary of the rule. We're continuing to take comments from the panel, and we'll be refining the rule language and drafting our sonar, and then going through the formal rulemaking process as laid out on this slide. And if you're interested in more about what we have and what we shared with the panel, it's all found on those web links, and I'm happy to take questions.
Questions, members? I've got one question. Do you regulate particulate matter emissions from other industries and their air permits as well?
Mr. Chair, yes. Particulate matter is subject to the National Ambient Air Quality Standards, and so we have to ensure that any facility that has an air permit that emits particulate matter is meeting, that its emissions won't cause or contribute to any violations of those health-based standards.
Okay. I'm just concerned that we're regulating an industry without some scientific data or something to back it up.
Mm-hmm. Again, Mr. Chair, there the EPA sets standards for fine particles, the PM 2.5, and for PM 10 particles.
Other questions? Representative Netson.
I'll let seniority go.
Well, thank you, Representative Netson. It's about time.
Representative Anzo.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Just so committee members understand, we've gone through some of this up north already and continue to go through it, but fugitive dust can and is defined oftentimes as dust that comes from truck tires. I'll let you think about that for a while.
Representative Metz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, you know, I just got to say I sat down with a few of the companies before today's meeting, and my understanding is in some of these rules we're potentially talking about having people go in and tar roads to get dust down. Do you see that being... you know, anyone who's got a dirt road in a business, that being applicable to them as well, potentially?
Mr. Chair, committee members, you know, frequently we do look at, when we have facilities that have a lot of unpaved roads and they have permits, we do look at conditions for keeping the dust down on those roads. And so, I mean, paving roads is an option, but there's also a lot of practices, watering roads, applying dust suppressants, and things that can be used to mitigate that. And with this industry, we're also interested in, you know, spilling if there's dry sand that's spilled, to make sure that that's swept up, and also the control of fugitive dust that's blowing off storage piles.
One quick follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Representative Metha.
Have you considered the actual carbon footprint of what it takes for, you know, the thickness of concrete or tar, whatever they chose to cover it with, would be to require these companies to go potentially put in on their properties, and what damage that has and what fugitive dust it creates at whatever plant they're getting that aggregate from somewhere else that's not regulated?
Mr. Chair, Representative Metzen, that is not something that I have considered. I think what we're looking at in the rule is a wide range of options for controlling dust from roads, and paving wouldn't necessarily be required.
Representative. Last follow-up, Mr. Chair. Thank you. And then I was just looking at the EQB citizen board makeup, and I noticed almost zero representation from Greater Minnesota outside of a city rather large. So Frontenac would be our only Greater Minnesota city represented, and I was just curious as to why there's not more representation where we're actually doing a lot of this processing on that board.
Mr. Chair, Representative Metz, are you referring to the MPCA Citizens Board? You said EQB?
The EQB Citizen Board.
I'm not on the EQB. I can't speak to that. I'm sorry.
Aren't you working with them to do all these things, or Mr. Chair?
Wait, Mr. Chair, Representative Metz, the three agencies are working cooperatively on these rules. I work for the Pollution Control Agency. Our rules don't have to go through the Environmental Quality Board. Should we go to hearing, they go through our board. So I'm not familiar with the membership of the Environmental Quality Board. I don't.
Ms. Nosler, do the proposed rules reflect the comments that we received in November?
Mr. Chair, at this time, we don't, you know, we haven't formally proposed rules. What we have is a draft that we've walked through with the committee in December and January, and we've worked through the comments that we've gotten in November. I know there's still some concerns that we need to hear.
Okay. Thank you for your testimony. Thank you for coming forward today. I'm sorry. All Representative Hertas? I'm sorry. Representative Hertas, we are running out of time, and we've got quite an agenda left. Very quickly.
Quickly. Does the agency monitor fugitive dust that's generated by gravel roads that are owned by the state, cities, townships, and communities?
Mr. Chair, Representative, we don't specifically monitor fugitive dust. We have across the state a network of monitors that measure ambient air.
Yes. Representative Constantine.
Actually, my question is for the chair. Would it be reasonable to maybe ask the DNR to come back on another day so we can facilitate the public input?
Yes, we were just talking about that briefly, and I think that's what we're going to do. We're going to forego the DNR's testimony today and bring some folks up that wanted to speak. Thank you for your testimony. Thank you for coming forward. First on the list, we're going to take these in order. First, I have to say that according to our rules, when we bring folks in, invite people in to speak on informational hearings, we try to get folks that we invite them in. We try to get as much information we can. We're not hearing any legislation today. When we hear legislation, we want people to come and testify. When we're changing laws, we're making new laws, we encourage that. We want that. It's one of the rules of the House that we do that. We want all of that to happen. We don't need to take public testimony when we have an informational hearing. We encourage it. We want it. If we have time, we do it. So we're going to make some time today. We've got about 10 minutes left, and we're going to take some folks in the order that they called in. And Alan Muller, President of Red Wing, resident of Red Wing, Goodhue County. If you're here, if you could come up quickly. Next on the list is Margaret Walsh. If you want to come forward. Darla Austin, on board. Please come forward. Yep. You were the first to the desk. Please state your name.
My name is Margaret Walsh, and I'm from Winona, and I would just like...
I have been breathing air and drinking water in Winona County for over 45 years, and I would like to continue to do so for the rest of my life and the life of my young relatives. There's a couple things here that I need to address as far as the transport of the sand and the talking about the facilities. We've had some major companies talk today, and in Winona we certainly are not using, they are not using any state-of-the-art equipment. There are not processing plants. Everyone that's talking about this topic of the silica sand, Winona's processing sand and piling it up in great big huge piles outside, and everything happens outside, not covered, not in any kind of facility. So I think the understanding that there's facilities and plants is not something that's happening in Winona County. They also move the sand in bulldozers, put it in the rail cars, and they sit along the river for days on end, uncovered, and they say they're supposed to be covered. There's the ability to cover them, but those things are not happening. And I think you have to look at a much more simplistic processing than the kind of testimony that you've heard here today in terms of where that silica sand is going in the air. And I think there's some really good things that happen, and I'd like to thank Mr. Seifert and the MPCA for the work they've done in listening to us. And I just hope that in the future the democratic process is a little bit more open for us, Chairman Hagbarth, than it was for today. And I do understand that it's an informational hearing, but the hearing has the assumption that the frac sand mining is going to go on, and so far in Winona County, I'm not seeing anybody talk about the fact that we don't want it there. So I think there is definitely a you have really kind of not listened to the fact that your assumption is that there will be that in the state, and you know, I'm not sure everybody in Winona County wants that. So, and so far we have been very successful in keeping it out of Winona County. So thank you for your time, and I'm sure we'll be talking again in the future.
Thank you. Please
thank you for letting us come forward, Mr. Tom Hackbar. And my name is Lynn Austin. I'm Darla's
Welcome.
Husband, and she could not speak. She's not feeling well.
Okay.
We really, some of my concerns is that I'm disappointed that I'm not prepared correctly, because I did have some really cool pictures I could have shown. But I have actually lots of situations. I live right next to a plant. I don't like the plant, mainly because of the fact that your question was about the silica sand and, you know, is it being tested? I believe that that it's not being tested correctly. I believe that the machines, well, let's say the dust is coming from my area, so the tester is in the wrong place as far as I consider, and the people with common sense would consider. You listen to the person test about the sand as far as, are we testing sand that's hitting the ground, falling on the railroad tracks, and being blown all over God's creation? And no, that person hasn't tested any of that sand. So I feel that the rules that we pass as far as in the rock business that everyone is talking about, the aggregates and all the rest of it, silica is the only thing I've ever worried about in my life as far as the rocks. It's not the sand that we grew up with in our sandbox. So Catherine did a great job as far as coming forward with the EQB and the MPCA and the agency that actually rules on it. So I feel that, you know, we've actually really, really done a great job with all those wonderful things. So that's what I really hope that this committee can continue with. I thank Jack for bringing up the fact that we, the people, did come. We really wanted to sit here and speak with all you people. So I kind of was curious about Uniman and how many of their retired workers have died of some type of a problem with their lungs over the years, considering that they did start in 1940 and we haven't had all the great things that Uniman has put through with their vacuum plants and all the rest of it. So, but when we can see it all over the ground and the dust is flying and the machine says zero, it was an off day. We only run it one out of every 6 days because we can't run it every day, because then the samples would get caught up and the filters would take too long to replace it. So it really drives me crazy that we don't test every day and we don't have a tester that can test every day. So I have problems because I really wanted to know, what does it take to have a plant or a situation have a problem when you have situations of trucks that are uncovered, where I can count, there's 11 trucks running down the road hauling this product, two are covered, nine aren't. Well, I got told that, guess what? I lost four people their jobs because I reported it to the city government, and all of a sudden, four truck drivers are now gone. So that's not my fault. That's their fault. They had one little button they had to push to cover their loads. They did not do it. So anyway, I just want better ambient testers, and I want to know what it takes to shut facilities down if they're not complying with the rules, instead of saying, ooh, I'm going to slap you on the hand, and the next 5 days we'll watch you and make sure that you're running everything correctly. So thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's great to have had a voice.
Thank you very much for testifying. Next on the list, first I should mention that we did offer a land stewardship project to come forward and testify, and they declined. And next on the list is Katie Hemenga. Did I get that right? On board after that is Amy Nelson. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
My name is Katie Hemenga, and I am a member of the Silica Advisory Panel. I am from which you've heard of several of our other members here earlier today. I'm also the former mayor and currently a resident of the city of Lake City in rural Wabasha and Goodhue County. I'm on the panel. I am the only natural resources professional, and natural resources never get invited to testify, and neither did I, but I will do my best here today to speak to the issue of reclamation. My community is home to what I believe is the largest unreclaimed mine in southeastern Minnesota. It's about a mile from my house. It's, I believe, about 35 acres in sand in size. It was abandoned within the last 10 years. An abandoned mine is a hole in the ground forever. You heard testimony today that these areas become wildlife management areas, and indeed they often do. How does that impact tax revenue into perpetuity? Generally, they end up in public ownership, and most certainly those that are in rural areas not adjoining existing metropolitan areas will end up in public ownership. Reclamation is uniquely challenging in our corner of the state. We are uncarst. It is the driftless region, the area of the state that was not glaciated. If you are uncarst, it matters not whether you stay a mile away from this trout stream or not. What matters is how close are you to features like sinkholes, where a pollution spill miles and miles from the trout stream can reach the trout stream in a matter of minutes. The science of ecology is less than 50 years old. And what we know with certainty is that if we continue to act with our natural resources and treat our environment as we have the last 100 years, it is unsustainable. We would not be in a situation of having polluted sites, degraded natural resources, had we been doing over the last 100 years what we know now. And what we know now is tiny as compared to what we're going to know over the course of the next 30 years. You didn't hear anyone talk about any scientific research that's going on in the area of reclamation, and I believe that's because it's not. I touch base with my alma mater, the University of Minnesota, and I touch base with the Science Museum of Minnesota, and there is no research going on at this time related to reclamation of sites in the karst region. My interest is in restoring ecological function to sites, and that goes beyond stabilizing slopes and making them green, which is what we have done in the past. So strategic use of strategic wetlands, protecting and restoring soil health, restoring the diversity of life on sites, these are the things that I'm interested in. And again, what we know is that we can't keep doing it the way we have been doing it in the past. You've heard it said that local governments may feel overwhelmed, and indeed they do. But they only know what they know. They're not particularly good at getting natural resources expertise, accessing that when they should, even though, as industry has shared often with the panel, they could pass those costs on directly to the industry. That is not their habit, and too often politics gets in the way and our natural resources suffer. Regarding reclamation permitting, reclamation oversight, and confirming compliance with reclamation plans, I am of the opinion that it is beyond the capacity of local units of government. I thank you for your time this afternoon.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Members, we are over our time. We're supposed to adjourn at 4:30, but we're going to go to 4:35 to give the full 15 minutes to the citizens that wanted to participate. So with that, Ms. Nelson, please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Chairman. My name is Amy Nelson. I am a resident of Hay Creek Township in Red Wing, Minnesota. I am also on the Silica Rulemaking Advisory Panel. And I'd like to show you a book. This is a book. We all get these. This happens to have Keith Fossen's name on it. He's my husband. He's also a township supervisor. I'm a sub for him, along with a supervisor for Jim McElrath, who's also a township supervisor. I am myself the chair of the Township Planning Commission, and I've been doing this for 3 years as far as following this, and I have been on this rulemaking committee for the last year, volunteering my time. And so I do know a little bit about it, and I really would have appreciated being involved just as a member of the panel in this whole discussion. There's a couple just small points I'll make to be able to allow other speakers. One of the main reasons I got involved with this was because there was land bought in my township for frac sand mining. If it would have been some of the reputable companies you've heard here today, I may not have even been involved. But on the deed, they said they were going to do a sand pit. They bought land adjacent to a residential development on a bluff above a state-designated trout stream, and then never even talked to us, not as township officials, not as Good Hugh County, nothing. When we tried to get meetings, they wouldn't talk to us, they wouldn't meet with us, nothing. Why? Because they were a hedge fund company. That's what we're scared of. A lot of these companies, I'm not worried about. I want regulations because I don't want a hedge fund company coming in, raping my land, walking away, leaving an unclaimed pit in karst above a trout stream. That's what I don't want. The one other point I'd like to make is that air quality is not all wonderful everywhere. It was only a year and a half ago that there was sand dust found in air filters in a school in Wisconsin. And that sand mine is over a quarter of a mile away. Why was it found? Because the nurse ended up noticing asthma symptoms in a multitude of children. So it's not all perfect. There are rules needed. And I would just like to remind you that there's a reason there's a skull and crossbones on a bag of sand when you go to Menards to buy it for sandblasting. There is a reason that OSHA ends up saying this is a hazardous material. And there is a reason that NIOSH is saying they don't recommend the use of sand for fracking. Because the levels at the places that they frack is 80% higher than the standards put forth. So all we're trying to do, we aren't trying to over-regulate anything. The only thing we're trying to do as citizens and local units of government is trying to protect our citizens. Thank you.
Thank you. One last testifier. We only have a few minutes left.
Yep.
Please state your name for the record.
My name is Lynn Shane. I'm on the City Council of Wabasha in Wabasha County. So we are, there are some rural communities being represented here today. I just wanted to make a couple of comments. This has been something I've been working on for a very long time. I, too, am on the Minnesota Silica Sand Advisory Panel. We put in a number of hours on this over the past year. And one of the things that I notice is that I really have enjoyed my interaction with industry. I've learned a lot about this industry. And what is great is that the good guys are here, if you want to say it. They're the top four silica sand producers, and yet they're not the only producers. And what scares little towns like mine is the little cowboy guys that want to come in and just do what they want to do. And that has been our experience. And so none of the smaller producers are in this room. It's just the top four guys that are setting a good example or doing things well, but you're not seeing the whole picture. And until you see the whole picture, you don't really have the truth. And the fact that, you know, we are part of local government. Local government is about as close to the people as you can come. Governor Dayton said he wants to make, he's making the commitment to make state government more accessible. And yet the local governments have not been invited to the table. Until prior, we were. We were invited to the table. Local government, all of a sudden, doesn't have a voice. And a lot of us spend a lot of our private time, unpaid, doing local government things, representing our neighbors because we believe in something better. We believe in our communities, and we believe in the right to set the style and type of community we want. So when we come up here and take the time to do that, even though we weren't invited, even though we were told we wouldn't have time, and obviously industry had an hour and a quarter, and we've been given, I've got 2 minutes. Even through that, I'm going to fight for my voice, and I'm going to fight for the voice of my communities because you guys were elected to represent us, and anytime you push us away, we're going to pull harder to get our voice heard. You shouldn't be pushing us away. You should be asking us, what's your experience? What's going on with you? I would tell you, in my experience, I would have hired, Uniman hired a guy in North Carolina. The U of M has a wonderful particulate studies area. Our own University of Minnesota, we're not even accessing as professionals. Our own professionals, the MPCA, the DNR, aren't even given the courtesy of the time and effort they've been putting in on your behalf, on our behalf. And quite honestly, sitting here, my blood just gets boiled because you're supposed to be representing us. And that includes all of us, not just this corner of young men who I am glad to know, but dear God, we are all here because we have a voice. So please, next time, would you please invite us to the table, and don't assume Northern Minnesota is the same as Southern Minnesota.
Thank you for your testimony. Members, next week we'll be having a hearing on both ferrous and non-ferrous mining, informational hearings, and also in your packet, we have this piece from House Research, nonpartisan House Research from Chris Kleeman. You've done a great job on putting this together, and people, please take note of that. It's on mining income and royalty taxation overview. Please take a look at that. Representative Considine.
Thank you for facilitating public input.
You're welcome. Meeting adjourned.